Jeffrey Lichtman for Beyond the Legal Limit. It's March 25th. Welcome back. And in this podcast, I want to talk about a few important things, I think. One is obviously the coming election, and again, how it's becoming that this is really an election between, or I guess the choice between the lesser of two evils in Trump and Biden. Both, any sane person would agree, are horrifically bad candidates and equally, actually, I don't even want to say equally bad people, but both bad people. But the country and the world is in such a state due to the last 3 years of Joe Biden because the world really follows America. And what America does impacts things 7,000, 10,000 miles away. So in my mind, there's really no choice but to get him out of office, even if it means putting an idiot like Trump back in. I'll go into some of that and some really funny stuff that did not make the news, certainly didn't make the mainstream news, relating to Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer, his fixer, whatever he is, and ended up cooperating against them. Michael Cohen made his fourth motion, that's four attempts, to terminate his supervised release, which is the period after you're released from prison, and you're supervised by a probation officer to make sure you're staying out of trouble, basically. It can impact your ability to travel. You've got to report to the probation officer. It's not that big of a deal. It's a pain, I suppose, but it's not nearly as bad as being in prison. And the term of supervised release for Michael Cohen was 3 years, which is it's standard, but it seems like it's a long time. You get out of jail, you want to have some freedom, and you've got a probation officer basically around your neck to some degree. I sometimes make motions to terminate supervised release early, and it's granted on occasion. It depends if you can show that supervised release is hurting your business because you can't travel when you want to quickly, so it affects your ability to keep a job perhaps, or that you're so obviously reformed that supervised release is not necessary. Those are usually the main grounds that work to terminate supervised release. Now, naturally, Michael Cohen, being on his fourth attempt, he was 0 for 3 before, and even though his term of supervised release is up in November, he insisted upon making a fourth motion. And if Cohen had come to me, which certainly would have been possible, I suppose, and asked me to help him with, again, the fourth attempt to terminate supervised release, and then when he told me that it was ending in November anyway, I would have told him no. You know, I'm not interested. It's just too dumb of a motion to make. It's so late in the game. You're about to get it terminated anyway. And making a fourth attempt really just is a bad signal to the judge. It just shows that you have no really respect for the law, for the supervised release that, you know, you were sentenced to. But the thing about law, the field of law, is that there's always a lawyer out there desperate enough either for some shine or some money, a few bucks. And that's how people like Michael Cohen can still hire lawyers for dumb motions like this. What happened with this attempt, though, really takes the cake. You're going to be shocked when I go through all of it with you. It's symptomatic of how dumb Donald Trump is that he ever trusted someone as slow-witted, a dim-wit, literally a half-wit, as Michael Cohen. And it explains, I suppose, why Trump's lawyers today are almost uniformly idiotic as Michael Cohen, save for a few. I'm also going to talk a little bit about my work week last week, which began in Chicago working on Chapo Guzman's son, a videos case. This is something that I did not anticipate, I suppose, when I was growing up. I represent Chapo Guzman, his wife, Emma Coronel, and all four of Chapo's sons, Ivan, Alfredo, Joaquin, and Ovidio. I'm not sure really how this came to be. I guess if I think about it, I can pinpoint it. Here we are. And I spent 2 days with Ovidio meeting with him and going over some of the massive discovery in the case. That's the evidence in the case. And I find him to be, and look, this is truthful. I'm not just saying this. He knows I feel this way. I find him to be smart, funny. He's very resilient, despite the fact that he's been held in isolation since October. I mean, strict isolation, the way his father was. He's had no family visits. He's allowed one 15-minute phone call per month. The regular prisoner gets 300 minutes per month in federal prison. A video gets 15 minutes because he's held in the special housing unit. And it's for his own safety, not because he's a problem, which is usually where they why they put people into the SHU, is what we call it, the special housing unit. So he's being kept there for his own safety, and yet he's being treated as if he's being punished for being in the SHU. But that's the MCC in Chicago. They're complete lunatics. As I said, a 15-minute, one a month. He has limited commissary privileges, books that I send to him for him to read, for him to give him something to do, are often lost or get to him weeks later. I hired a paralegal to visit with him three times per week, partly so that he'd have some human contact, also to work on the case a bit. That was suspended. The prison suspended that paralegal's privileges in December for 6 months for a reason that, honestly, I can't even articulate or decipher. It makes no sense at all. They invited me to make an appeal, which I did instantly in January when we got the decision, and it's been now 2.5 months after I submitted an appeal. Absolutely no response, zero, nothing, not even an indication that they received my appeal. But this is what the prison system is like. It's just completely arbitrary, capricious, dishonest, and probably illegal as well. And what I thought about this week when I saw a video and spent some time with him, I realized how much more I like him than most clients. Now, I understand he's charged with some horrific acts, but as I've always said on here, I don't judge a client based on what he's charged with. I based on how he is when I'm with him after all that, after he's charged. And he rarely complains, despite the torture that he's going through, you know, despite the fact that he's facing a mandatory life sentence and he's only in his early 30s. He's appreciative, he's funny, he's smart, and he's willing to work on the case instead of just bemoaning his fate like many clients do. They just can't even consider working on a case because they need to complain. And I understand. It's not like I'm not insensitive to that. I get it. A video and I have at least one video call from prison per week when I'm not in Chicago, and I genuinely enjoy speaking to him. He's a voracious reader. I mentioned that I send him books, mostly books on World War II, which I've got to find in Spanish. And his English is actually pretty good. We can communicate without a translator for the most part. I also realized last week that the prosecutors and federal agents on the case are immensely more likable than opposing counsel in civil cases. Usually my opposing counsel are federal prosecutors or state prosecutors, but occasionally I have civil cases. And I find that, you know, look, these federal prosecutors, we're at each other's throats. The agents, not so much, because there's not like any kind of direct dealing with them in a trial, but we're at each other's throats. But there's a level of respect, usually, if you're competent, and not every lawyer is, but there's a level of respect and professionalism that goes on. But it doesn't happen for some reason in civil cases, and I'm going to explain why. I have a case in which I'm representing a 60-year-old man who was sued a few years ago for an alleged rape that occurred when he was like 17 years old, I guess about 43 years ago, when he and the alleged victim were still in high school. And you're wondering, well, how can somebody sue after all those years? Well, I'm going to tell you. Before 2019, when in New York State, a plaintiff had 3 years to sue someone for sexual misconduct. In 2019, in the middle of the Me Too movement, of course, you know, New York has to be reactionary, that statute of limitations was extended to 20 years, but the extension was not retroactive. So it's what it was called as the Adult Survivors Act, provided victims of sexual misconduct in New York with a 1 year look back window, which ran from November 24, 2022 until November 24, 2023, giving alleged survivors of sexual abuse the opportunity to raise claims that otherwise would be barred by the statute of limitations. So naturally, you had tons of cases that were filed during that 1 year window, and some of them were like from decades ago and were completely bonkers. Bob Dylan was sued by a crackpot lawyer on behalf of a woman who claimed she was raped by Dylan in 1965 when she was supposedly 12 years old. Dylan's lawyers, and he's got a really good lawyer who's a former federal prosecutor. He was a great federal prosecutor back in the early 90s, and I guess now he's a top entertainment lawyer. His lawyers described the case as a lawyer-driven sham, and I couldn't agree more. And it was ultimately withdrawn, and the woman's nutcase lawyers both were sanctioned. But I'm sure that there are real cases which were brought during that period. Although as a defense lawyer, I'm a defense lawyer, I felt that opening up a one-year window for people to sue for things that occurred decades ago was really inviting trouble and is ridiculous. I do understand, though, why some women don't sue within the original statute of limitations. I get it. I'm not insensitive to that. I know that it's not an easy thing to do. I know that oftentimes they're up against rich and powerful men, and it's not so easy. But look, the law is the law, and there's a reason why there's a statute of limitations. But what I've learned in my career is that lawyers fighting for freedom, for someone's freedom, or to put someone in jail for the rest of their lives, instead of money, are infinitely more well-behaved than civil lawyers whose entire careers are just about suing for money. And in the case that I'm talking about, the fellow that was sued by a woman he supposedly raped when he was 17, 43 years ago, I have an opposing attorney who, during her very first call with me, when we introduced ourselves just to talk, you know, very preliminarily about the case, she hung up on me. I mean, I shit you not. Naturally, of course, as I said, it was a woman, because men traditionally don't hang up on people on the phone. I don't even recall the circumstances of what caused her to hang up on me, but I do remember laughing after she hung up on me. It was like we're children here, and like you can't handle discussing, you know, maybe some difficult things with opposing counsel, even though it was an introductory phone call. But this is, you know, I probably said something like, we're not going to give you money on the first day if that's okay with you. And that made her hysterical, and she had to hang up the phone on me. This is exactly the kind of temperament I want for an opponent. I'm going to be honest with you. As someone who needs to be medicated to get through a phone call. In 34 years of practice, I've never had anyone hang up on me before. And I'm talking, I have had some ugly conversations in 34 years. I'm actually, regardless, pretty easy to deal with on cases, especially at the beginning. If the case goes to trial or is ramping up towards a trial, I'm going to admit that I'm very difficult to deal with. I'm not the kind of person I would want to have as an opponent because, you know, I'm going to outwork you. I'm going to torture your witnesses in a case. This is not anything that's surprising to anybody who's had a trial with me. I'm very tenacious. I'm the most aggressive, and I really fight to win every case. Even if the case seems impossible, I believe I can win. And sometimes we do win these impossible cases more often than not. So I'm going to fight you to the death. But I doubt that many prosecutors will say that I'm unfair or dishonest. I just fight harder than what they're used to. That's it. But the opposing lawyer in the civil case and me, we patched things up and we were getting along pretty well. And recently we reached a point in the case where I felt that the case should settle. This is not like a zillion-dollar case. I felt that the case should settle. We were sort of at a position where neither side hated each other that much. It was an emotional case, certainly for the plaintiff, the woman, deservedly so. She claimed she was raped, and that's not something anyone gets over anytime soon or really ever at all, you know, assuming that it happened, and I'm not passing judgment now here. I told the lawyer that I thought we should settle, and she agreed. But before we could even attempt to get numbers together and financial records together, the lawyer insisted upon a deposition of a third-party witness, someone she claimed had also been raped by my client 43 or 44 years ago, whatever it is. I told her that this was not a good idea. This was not a good time. We're trying to settle the case. We have a window here to bring in somebody who claims that she was raped by my client at this stage is just, I mean, you know what's going to happen. It's going to create bad feelings. It's going to get ugly. I thought that this was obvious, but the lawyer said, you know, her client insisted upon it, which in my mind is ridiculous. You know that you can settle the case. And look, we settle these cases not because somebody's guilty or responsible, just because it makes sense to settle it without admitting liability sometimes. I mean, it's just how it is, just to get rid of the case and save people money and heartache. But when a lawyer tells me that her client won't let her do something, this is how you handle it. You tell your client no. Just like you tell your child who's putting his or her hand near the flame on the stove, no, this is not good for you. I'm going to stop you because this isn't good for you. But sometimes the clients know better, and sometimes you have weak lawyers that are unable to stop a client. So we had the deposition just this past Friday, and the witness that was brought in was just a mess. She couldn't focus. She couldn't answer questions directly. And during my time questioning her, she was just confused. She just was just a horrible witness. I mean, really, she was petty. She was jealous about things from high school or from the early 80s. I mean, still, it's 2024. Maybe get over your petty jealousies from, I don't know, 1982? Like, it's time. You know, but sometimes people don't achieve what they want in their life from high school, and high school is the apex of their life. Those are the people I find that are still angry about what's happened to them since high school. Somebody like me, I was successful in high school. I was popular. I was editor of my high school paper, but my life got better. It improved. It reached greater heights, shockingly, from when I was 18 years old when I graduated. So I look back on high school and frankly, you know, yeah, it's fine. It was, you know, good and bad. Who cares? It's the past. But the reason why you don't want to have a bad witness during a deposition is because it sort of takes away from your case. If you bring somebody in as a, here's my big witness, and then the witness flops, it makes the lawyer look like a fool. And it, again, it takes away from the strength of the case. And this is what was happening during the deposition. It had to be very frustrating for opposing counsel. I'm asking a simple yes or no question, and I get 5 minutes of just imbecility, just nothing relevant was coming out. And then I would have to re-ask the question, and it was very frustrating. So I could see that the lawyer was getting frustrated, and she was getting frustrated with me because I was daring to try to nail down some answers. So that's what was happening. And it, again, I'm a criminal defense lawyer by trade. I'm not some putsy civil lawyer that spends my days doing putsy state civil stuff that frankly nobody gives a shit about and no one will ever care about 100 years from now. I've cross-examined some of the most well-known cooperating witnesses in the history of America on the biggest stages of America during my career. My crosses, and look, I'm not saying anything that anybody, including the media, including my prosecutor opponents, would admit. My crosses are brutal. They're very thorough and designed to not make the witness feel good. And the witnesses are usually trained lifelong liars that I'm dealing with. So I really have to dig in and be tough on them, because it's not so easy to get past their very formidable lies that they make. But like what I'd like to say is, and I say this with real seriousness, and again, anyone who's ever tried a case with me or against me will be forced to admit this, I have broken every single cooperating witness I have ever faced. Now, there are different degrees of success, but there is not a single cooperating witness, and I mean somebody who is alleged to have cooperated in the crime with the defendant, is now cooperating with the government against that defendant, his former co-conspirator, allegedly. I've crushed most of them. I've certainly beaten all of them, and none of them have come off after the examination better than they did before it started. And although the crosses can be brutal, and look, this is what it is. This is the job. They're ethical. They're the product of a ton of investigation. And I think they're, you know, usually focused, although some judges may disagree. And when the crosses happen in a civil case against someone who isn't a lifelong criminal, it makes no difference to me. I'm treating the witness like it's the turncoat boss of the Genovese crime family, if need be. I don't lessen the work, because if the case is just about money, instead of a client's freedom. I don't treat it, well, this isn't important, so I'll half-ass it. To me, all witnesses exist for one reason, for me to destroy their credibility, period. I'm not there to curry favor. I'm not there to be nice. I'm there to wreck your case. I can be polite. I think I am, and I'm very effective at it. This is why I've been successful, because I'm effective at cross-examinations. I'm effective at examinations. I'm effective at civil depositions as well. I can think of one, and I've talked about this, where there was a $125,000 offer in the morning when the deposition started, and 2 hours later, it was $1 million because I crushed the witness who was a lawyer. And look, I hate to sound like a preening jackass, but it's true. I'm sorry. I don't know what you want me to say, but it's true. So the deposition on Friday was going as expected, with the witness just sounding horrible and getting batted around. And then the opposing lawyer started, as I said, getting frustrated herself, and she's rolling her eyes, and she's got her head in her hands, and it's on Zoom, this one. And it was just ridiculous. And then she started answering the questions for the witness. And it was like, it was fucked. I mean, it was bizarre to say the least. I got pissed and I told her to stop, and she just lost her shit and ended the deposition in an emotional huff. Now, that's it. That's how I'm ending the deposition, which of course I'll finish after making a motion to the judge, spending more money of my client, sadly, and her client, which she clearly doesn't care. And I'll compel the continuation of the deposition, and I'll get it done. In 34 years of practice, I've never had a lawyer hang up a phone on me, and I've never had a deposition halted before it was over. In this case, it's now happened. Both of them have happened with the same opposing counsel, some like an emotionally fragile lawyer. And as you can imagine, the chances of settling the case now are significantly less than before the deposition. Sometimes people listen. Sometimes people are too emotionally involved and their brains shut off and they don't think. Those are people that in real life you try to avoid because they're idiots. Anyway, back to the hysterics. I fight for people's freedom, and the prosecutors never lose their mind as bad as what happened here, with so much more at stake also. The female federal prosecutors that I've dealt with are oftentimes tough as nails and very formidable. As good as the men oftentimes, and oftentimes significantly better. The female federal judges I have been before are oftentimes brilliant and tougher than any of the men in the same building. I'm thinking of Denise Coate in the Southern District. It's just so tough, so strong, so smart, easily the toughest judge in the building. I enjoy being in front of her because I think she's fair. Very tough on defense lawyers if they're not prepared, even if they are prepared sometimes. She's very tough on defendants who deserve what she's about to mete out. Rena Radji, formerly of the Eastern District in Brooklyn and now a Second Circuit Court of Appeals judge. She should have been on the Supreme Court. These are Coate and Radji are just two brilliant, very tough women, very tough judges. Forget women. But I like them. I mean, they're wonderful people also. Other judges I can think of too. Former Judge Shira Shinlin, who I had during the Gotti case. I mean, the woman could not have been the best judge I've ever been in front of in my life. Loretta Preska and Kimball Wood in Manhattan in the Southern District of New York. Just tough, fair, and brilliant. Colleen McMahon is another federal judge in Manhattan, Southern District. She yells at me a lot. I yell back at her. I really like her. She's very tough. She's very fair. To me, she's also really smart, even when she's wrong. I've had her reversed, and she's yelled at me about it. And I say reversed, I mean by the Court of Appeals after she made a decision. But she's great. And I'm sure they all, these women, face sexism in their careers and overcame it to get to where they are. But I can tell you this, I am certain they never hung up on a lawyer or had a mental break during a deposition. Instead, they just toughed it out and they overcame. It's not easy being a woman in the legal field. Clients and oftentimes lawyers don't take you seriously, even judges, due to your sex. So the one thing you can't do is give them a reason, an excuse to not take you seriously due to the fact that you're a woman. You're just letting down all the women that follow you. Now, look, I'm not exactly a champion of women's rights, but that's how I feel. Now, I want to quickly go into the Michael Cohen debacle. By the way, we're also going to have a section on music, which I'm thrilled about. I'm really thrilled. That's coming soon. So gird your loins for that. It's going to be punk rock music, or at least a band. Anyway, let me finish up the Michael Cohen story. As I said earlier, he was making his fourth attempt to try to terminate his supervised release, despite it being over in November. Anyway, keep in mind, again, that before there was a Helena Baba, an incompetent imbecile of a lawyer for Trump, there was Michael Cohen. Helena Baba showed us that it was possible for Trump to have two lawyers, dumb like Cohen, including Cohen. And here's what happened with Cohen's motion to terminate supervised release. And I beg of you, this actually happened. It did not make the mainstream news. It made some legal newspapers like the New York Law Journal, but did not make the mainstream. I'm absolutely stunned that it didn't. Now, in order to make a motion to terminate supervised release, as I said earlier, you need to show the reasons why you deserve it. And lawyers with a functioning brain know that along with the facts included in the motion, you put in case law. Every motion you make isn't just facts. It's got to have law supporting the facts, supporting what you're moving for. A motion is a movement for relief. So you have to put in case law as well. And sometimes you'll have cases that have similar fact patterns, not to everything that you're arguing, but maybe just one piece of it. Like you could say, even though supervised release is up in 7 or 8 months, you can still make such a motion and it can be accepted this late in the game. Now, the two fact patterns as to why the supervised release should be terminated can be completely opposite. But the point for that case that you're looking to put in is that you can make the motion so late into the term of supervised release. And sometimes that's what you do. I mean, there may be 30 points you're trying to make. You could have hundreds of cases submitted in such a motion like this. And here's what Michael Cohen did. Now, Michael Cohen was a lawyer, remember. And remember also that he went to prison, federal prison, for federal tax evasion. So Cohen hires a lawyer who sends him a draft of the motion. I guess the lawyer felt, look, you got to see it before it goes in. You know, Michael, even though you're clearly a mouth-breathing idiot, you still need to look at it. And Cohen reads it and sends it to another of his lawyers who tells him, you know, Michael, maybe it might make some sense if the motion, I don't know, cited some case law. That's a good idea. You know, like everyone learns the first day of law school. Cohen passes this information on to his first lawyer, the one that wrote the motion. And incredibly, Cohen sends the lawyer several emails with case citations and summaries of the cases, except there's only one problem here. Cohen, although he was technically a lawyer when he worked for Trump before he was disbarred, is actually a moron. And instead of doing the research himself, we have websites and there are books where you do legal research. It's not very difficult. Westlaw, Lexis, it's not very difficult. You know, I've been doing it for decades. Instead, he did the research himself. While doing it, he went to an AI, artificial intelligence website, and he did a search, which spit out the cases and summaries, except they were all fabricated by the artificial intelligence search engine. Cohen's lawyer, who received these materials, these case citations, and also the summaries, the names of the cases, is such a careful lawyer that he never bothered to read a single case that Cohen sent him and instead just shoved them into his motion. He didn't even look to quote. He just did it. He just shoved it in without reading a single case. It's stunning. And how do we know that he didn't read the cases? Because the cases don't exist. If you try to pull up the site on Westlaw or Lexis, they don't come up because the cases are fake. Fake. And the lawyer is an idiot, clearly. I mean, it's almost inconceivable. He puts the cases and summaries into the motion for early termination of supervised release and sends it to the federal judge who'd be deciding the motion. The second lawyer that Cohen had hired, the one who suggested that actual legal cases be put into the motion, reads the motion after it's filed and alerts the judge. She was obviously checking the cases to see if they stood for what Cohen's motion said they stood for, and she said she was unable to verify several cases cited in the initial motion by Cohen's lawyer. And it was the right thing to do, even though she was going against her client, because, you know, it's an ethical thing. You have to bring it to the court's attention. At that point, the judge realized that the cases cited by Cohn's lawyer were fake and ordered Cohn's lawyer to explain why he shouldn't be sanctioned for submitting fake cases in a legal motion. In order to be sanctioned, however, the judge needs to find bad faith of the lawyer. And the judge ultimately decided not to sanction Cohn's lawyer, and he wrote, quote, his citation to non-existent cases is embarrassing and certainly negligent, perhaps even grossly negligent, but the court cannot find that it was done in bad faith. This actually happened. But here's another part. On top of that bit of idiocy, the judge had to now decide the motion, just taking out the fake cases, and denied the motion to terminate supervised release. Why? Because the basis for the motion to terminate supervised release, according to Cohn and his lawyer, was that when Cohn testified in the Trump civil case in New York a few months ago, I think in October, the lawyer wrote that Cohn's testimony showed a, quote, willingness to provide truthful accounts of his experiences and demonstrates an exceptional level of remorse and commitment to upholding the law. So the basis for the fourth attempt was because now he's testified in court, he testified honestly and truthfully, he has remorse, he cares about justice. There's only one problem. The judge rejected this, saying that Cohn's testimony during the Trump civil trial actually provided the grounds to deny the motion to terminate supervisor release. Why? The judge noted that in the civil case against Trump, Cohn testified, quote, repeatedly and unambiguously that he was not guilty of tax evasion and that he had lied under oath to the federal judge when he pleaded guilty to those crimes. That's what the judge said. Michael Cohn testifies that although he pled guilty to tax evasion and went to jail for it, he was actually innocent and that he lied. He committed perjury during that guilty plea. The judge wrote, that testimony, quote, gives rise to two possibilities. One, that Cohn committed perjury when he pleaded guilty before the federal judge, or two, Cohn committed perjury in his October 2023 testimony in the state civil case against Trump. Either way, it is perverse to cite this testimony, as Cohn's lawyer did, as evidence of Cohn's commitment to upholding the law. And that obviously was the basis for the denial. But think about the comedy of errors slash stupidity. Not only did Cohn's lawyer use fake cases for support of his motion, but he claimed that Cohn's perjury in the state case against Trump should get him some credit with the court, instead of he should have been charged with perjury. Look, I can tell you this. I don't even know what artificial intelligence is. I'm not going to lie. I have no idea how to use it. I have no idea where to find it online, if it's something you download or you go to. I would have no idea where even to find fake legal cases. Someone like Michael Cohn and his mouth-breathing lawyer seems to know all about this. So just when you thought it couldn't get worse than Halina Baba, I give you Trump's old lawyer and his own moronic, also a mouth breather, his lawyer. Now we're going to take a break and we're going to come back and we're going to discuss punk rock music. This is the highlight of the podcast. Be right back. Jeffrey Lichtman for Beyond the Legal Limit. Now, punk rock music came out, I suppose, you know, in the mid-70s, as kind of a rejection of classic rock music, which punk musicians believed was too corporate. The early bands in punk were commonly accepted as the Ramones, which is one of my all-time favorite bands. I mean, if you haven't listened to the Ramones, there's something significantly wrong with you. The Sex Pistols, perhaps the New York Dolls, or the Jam, the Buzzcocks. And in my mind, however, punk rock really started earlier in the 60s. Certainly the Velvet Underground was a huge influence, if not a punk band itself. But let me just say from the start, I am not a studied music historian or a studied musician. I just listen to a lot of music. And I know a lot without knowing that I know it. It sort of seeps into your bones when you listen to music all the time and you're really into it. It just gets into your brain when you love music, and it's there for the taking when you talk about it. So don't hold me to these dates, but this is what I experienced. This is what I remember, and I've got a pretty good memory for music. Punk music has short songs, fast, short, harsh music, harsh vocals sometimes, totally different from classic rock, which was more technically proficient and seemingly more carefully crafted, at least for the good bands. But to a 13 to 17-year-old, to me, punk kicked ass. I hated everyone pretty much and everything at that time of my life, all authority certainly. And that's exactly what punk was. It was about defiance, defying your parents, defying your teachers, defying all authority. And the music just ripped through your body. It was physical. It was shocking. It was amazing. And there are so many good punk bands. As I said, the Ramones are, to me, were at the very top. They have probably 50 incredible songs. They're all like a minute and a half to 2.5 minutes long, and they're all incredibly catchy. But my all-time favorite punk band, assuming that you could call them punk, is The Clash. Granted, Joe Strummer, their leader, was a left-wing socialist savage with fucked-up teeth, but I didn't care because back then I probably wasn't too far off from that mindset. The Clash were a British band, very angry, very talented. Now, I'm not going to go into a history of the band, but suffice it to say that I was legitimately heartbroken when they broke up. I was lucky enough to see them in concert in 1981 when I was 16. I think I saw them in New Jersey at Convention Hall in Asbury Park, I believe. And it was right after they had hit their peak with London Calling and Sandinista. It was right before they released Combat Rock. So that was it was all their sweet spot. They weren't around that long, frankly. Now I'm going to play the first bit of Seconds off of the first song off their second album, which is called Give Them Enough Rope. To me, this is the most powerful start. And it really is, to me, this is The Clash. It's the most powerful start to any album in the history of music. And look, I say this. This is serious. The beginning of this album is the strongest, most powerful start to any album in the history of rock and roll music. Apologies to Led Zeppelin III and the Immigrant Song. The Clash's song is called Safe European Home, and the song is about their trip to Jamaica to learn a little bit about ska music, to get some ideas for writing, and to write some songs when they were in Jamaica. The trip was a total disaster, and as white Brits in Jamaica back then in the mid-70s, they were not treated well. I can only describe the beginning of this song as an assault. A punch in the face, and it is pure essence of punk music. The Clash at its all-time finest. I want you to listen to the drum getting hit one time at the very start, and then listen to the song 20 times. Safe European Home. Listen to the vocals, the crushing guitars, the lyrics, which include, quote, I went to the place where every white face is an invitation to robbery. Here is the first 1 minute and 16 seconds of Safe European Home. Gird your loins. To me, this is perhaps the greatest Clash song. Go ahead, Mr. Producer.
Robbery. I'm sitting here in my safe European home. I wanna go back.
Now, regardless of whether you know much about the class, I mean, how insanely great was that? Really? I mean, come the fuck on. Listen to it again. You can listen to it 100 times, and it's not enough. You may not know much about The Clash, but you certainly know some of their music. You may not even know that it's them. I'm going to play a few snippets of their most famous stuff. And here's the first 35 seconds of London Calling, their first, I suppose, really big song that made them international stars. And then they became known as, this is true, the only band that matters. The cover of London Calling, the album where the song London Calling is on, is one of the most famous rock pictures of all time, with their bassist destroying his guitar on the stage of, I believe it was the Palladium in New York City. What makes the cover even more fantastic, and I don't know many people that know this, is that it copies in terms of the colors, in terms of the black and white photo, the pink and green lettering, the font, the placement of an Elvis Presley album from, I don't know, decades before. The Clash obviously took themselves very seriously. Here is the first 35 seconds of London Calling, and you have heard this song, I hope. If not, you need to listen to this entire double album. It is that good. But here is the beginning of London Calling. It's just incredible. Here you go, the first 35 seconds. Mr. Producer, let it rip. Here's their traditional sound from the same album, which showed that a major musical influence of theirs was Jamaican ska music. I mentioned this before. And it's, you know, again, I'm not a musician, and I'm certainly not a historian or even somebody who ever studied music. I took one music class in college with Mr. Albrecht. He was such a nerd. It was stupid music class, and he had a hot wife. I don't know why I remembered. I don't know how he had a hot wife. Whatever. I digress. But ska music, to me, Jamaican ska music is the precursor to reggae. And it's all over the album London Calling and the album Sandinista. Anyway, here's some other quick hits from that album. Here's 46 seconds of Spanish Bombs. Go ahead.
In the days of 39, oh please leave the Vendana open, Frederico lockers dead and gone, bullet holes in the cemetery wall, the black car of the Johnny of the beer, Spanish bombs on the Costa Rica, my dying in on the DC-10 tonight, Spanish bombs, you got the quiero y bonito, just the cuera, oh my god, a thong.
Just incredible music. I mean, it's incredible. Here's 58 seconds of Revolution Rock. You can hear the Jamaican influence. It's just incredible. 58 seconds of Revolution Rock. Stay with me here. This is important stuff. Mr. Producer, 58 seconds of Revolution Rock. Finally, here's their big hit on the album, if you can call it that. And this song kind of bummed me out in a way. It just became too played. Sometimes a song can be so great, but if it's overplayed, it just kind of ruins it for you because everybody loves it and you want it to be your thing and not everybody's thing. And it just got played too much. And also the song is kind of too polished for The Clash. It didn't really belong on the album, even though it is just a fantastic song. And to me, it wasn't really punk, but it's still great. And the song is Train in Vain. Here's the first 42 seconds of Train in Vain. Mr. Producer, 42 seconds, Train in Vain. Go ahead. Certainly, you've heard that song. It's an incredible song, and it's really, this album is really the standard Clash sound. But I want to play part of one song from the same album. It's called The Card Cheat. Not nearly as well known. I would call it a deep cut, so to speak. It's about a guy who cheats at cards and is executed. Their songs were really harsh. One of their songs off of Sandinista is Somebody Got Murdered, and it's sung in this happy you have to listen to it. Somebody Got Murdered. It's not what you would expect, but their songs can really be harsh. Here's a minute, 22 seconds of The Card Cheat. I just find that this song it's just incredible. It's just, it just brings you up and then smashes you down. A minute, 22 seconds of The Card Cheat. Mr. Producer, go ahead. Another song on that same album, and I've discussed this before, is the song that is in my ears minutes before every trial that starts for me. And I've been doing this, you know, trials for over 20 years, and this song has been in my ears before every single trial. The song is Guns of Brixton, and it just exemplifies every bit of defiance to me in both music and some of the lyrics. I'm just going to play 51 seconds of Guns of Brixton. And as I prepped for this podcast, listening to this music, now I listen to The Clash a lot still, but when I listened to Guns of Brixton, it brought tears to my eyes, as it does every time I listen to it in court, without fail. And all of this music really does, and incredibly, it's 45 years later, when I was a boy, when I first listened to it. Music is so powerful this way, but here's 51 seconds of Guns of Brixton, and I think you'll have an idea as to why it gets me riled up and ready to kick the shit out of the witnesses that are going to be in front of me. Here you go.
but you'd have to answer too.
The Clash broke up, as I said, after a handful of albums. Their two leaders, Joe Strummer and Mick Jones, went on their own and had some levels of success. Mick Jones was in a popular band that he started called Big Audio Dynamite, and Joe Strummer, as a solo artist, mainly had some minor success. Here's Mick Jones's song. It's a gem. You've never heard it. I'm certain of it. It's called Esquerita. Esquerita, which is about a musician from the 50s who was an inspiration for Little Richard. Esquerita himself is somebody that you should listen to. You probably haven't, unless you're a musician listening to this podcast. But here's Mick Jones' song called Esquerita. The song is gold. I'm going to give you 1 minute and 4 seconds of Esquerita, and it has this infamous lyric at the end. This is what it is. I'm going to read you the lyric. I think you have to listen to the whole song, though, if you want to get to it. Here's the lyric. His real name was Esquerita. Beat up on his woman with a vacuum cleaner. I'm going to say to you, you know, a minute and four before you listen to it, Mr. Producer, get ready to play it. Is there a better song ever? I'm going to tell you that. Is there a better song ever? Mr. Producer, a minute, 4 seconds of Esquerita. Go ahead. Finally, as I said, Joe Strummer did some great stuff on his own. Here's a song from an album that came out after he died. He died early of a heart attack. Horrible. The album is from 2003. It's called Streetcore. The song is Coma Girl. And here's the first minute and 5 seconds. Joe Strummer's vocals were still outstanding 20 years after the Clash were done, and such a tragedy that he died young. The other classics on the album are Get Down Moses and his cover of Bob Marley's Redemption Song, which is just incredible. Here is a minute and 5 seconds of Coma Girl. Mr. Producer, do your magic.
I was calling through a festival way out west. I was thinking about love and the acid test. At first I got real dizzy with a real rockin' gang. And then I saw the Coma Girl on the excitement gang. And the rain came in from the wide blue yonder. Through all the stages I wandered.
Okay, I'm sorry I made you listen to so much music, but it's important to me, and somehow, some way, you're still listening to this podcast, so I hope it becomes important to you. On another complete topic, we saw in the news the violent attack by illegals on the Texas National Guard last week. Over 100 migrants broke through razor wire. They're knocking down guards as they illegally crossed into El Paso over the El Paso border. Just a wild scene. Last week, Texas had begun to prepare implementing a new law to allow state and local authorities to make arrests for illegally entering the country. But an appeals court naturally blocked the measure hours after the U.S. Supreme Court said that it would allow the law to go into effect. For 3 years, America, under Joe Biden, has allowed or refused to stop this invasion. And that's what it is. Look, left, right, center, whatever you are, it's an invasion and everybody agrees. It's one of the few things that everybody in the country can agree on. And it's in a violent invasion now. And it's clear that we're going to pay a heavy price for it. And we are already. The Democrats under Biden are obviously allowing and encouraging this for a policy reason. It will result, and it's not, doesn't matter to them that it's going to result, and it has resulted in increased crime, increased terrorism, an inability to take care of Americans as it strains the welfare system, the healthcare system, the school systems, housing. These are facts, not me as any kind of partisan hack. At the very least, we'll pay for it after the 2030 census, which counts illegals. And there are maybe, I don't know, 8 million, 10 million illegals who entered under Biden. No one really knows how many, but many millions. Joe Biden, when he came into office, reversed Trump's policy, which excluded undocumented illegals from congressional representation. Biden will ensure that when congressional seats are divided after the 2030 census, that states with illegals will have those illegals counted, and more seats will be spent on illegals who are getting basically bribed. They're getting paid by Democrats with programs and money more than the average American citizen gets. Just ask the illegals in New York City who are staying at four-star hotels with free maid service while veterans are homeless on those very same streets. In a recent bipartisan Gallup poll, Americans name immigration as the most important problem facing the U.S. 28% of Americans think that. A separate question in the poll found a record high 55% of U.S. adults, up 8 points from last year, saying that, quote, large numbers of immigrants entering the United States illegally is a critical threat to U.S. vital interests. The prior high in this poll was 50% in 2004. This is the main driver for Biden's dismal poll numbers, which have his approval rating at 40% right now, the lowest of any incumbent president in March of his election year, going back all the way to Jimmy Carter. 41% was the previous lowest, and that was George Bush the Elder, or I call him the full Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, who lost his reelection attempt. Biden also has low marks on the economy, obviously. Everybody knows nobody's better off than they were 4 years ago, and his handling of foreign affairs. Finally, his handling of Middle Eastern affairs is at 27% approval, which is presumably the reason why he's come out so strongly now against Israel in its war with Hamas terrorists. In Chuck Schumer, his speech about the Israeli-Hamas war, he made clear what the administration wants in the Middle East. Keep in mind that Schumer, again, was sent out by Biden to make this speech in an effort to help Biden's reelection prospects. Period. Full story. That's it. It's the only reason why he made the Schumer, who pretends to be a friend of Israel, came out and just blasted Israel. Now, again, every last thing that Biden is doing now in the Middle East, despite the fact that dozens of Americans were killed by Hamas, it's just to get votes. Schumer in his speech blamed Hamas. He blamed the Palestinian Authority president, Mahmoud Abbas. He blamed Israel's, in his mind, right-wing government, and he blamed Israel's prime minister, Netanyahu, and called for his removal. Blamed all of these equally, as if Israel is equal to the Hamas Muslim terrorists. He blamed Palestine. Again, I mean, it's just absolutely stunning to me. The one thing he didn't blame is the cause for all the mayhem in the Middle East. Iran doesn't even mention them. No blame for Iran, which is responsible for the war, which arms Hamas, which arms Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has shot thousands of rockets into Israel over the last few years and shoots them daily as of today. Instead, it was reported that Biden's administration released billions more in frozen money for Iran, which will obviously be used for terrorism. And then we also learned that Biden's team begged Iran to help them stop the Houthis, another Iranian terror proxy, from attacking ships in the Red Sea's shipping corridors. Remember when the Houthis, this ragtag bunch of scumbag Muslim terrorists, were attacking ships? Joe Biden got very tough. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. Instead, he got on his knees and started washing the knobs of the Iranian mullahs. Biden and his Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, have come out vocally against Israel finishing off Hamas in Rafah, which is the last stronghold of Hamas, which means they're clearly calling for Hamas to remain in power. They say that they're not, but they're telling Israel, don't finish off Hamas, which means there's going to be more dead Israelis because Hamas will stay in power, and then there will be another destruction of Gaza, and everybody will cry again about how unfair it is. The reason I'm telling you this is not to discuss the war again. I'm sick of it. I'm really sick of it. But to explain to you how dangerous this Biden administration is and why they need to be replaced. Our Secretary of State, Blinken, told Israel's prime minister that Israel may be globally isolated if it enters Rafah and finishes off Hamas. But the reason Israel will be isolated globally and is becoming isolated is because America is saying things like this publicly, because they're abandoning Israel publicly, and that's what drives global policy and global opinion. If America doesn't support Israel, then no one will, which is clear because there's so much Jew hate all over the world. Give people a reason to come out against Israel and they'll take it. They did it when Obama did it. Now they're doing it with Blinken. All Blinken has to say is what Putin of Russia said after 133 Russians were slaughtered by, you guessed it, Muslim terrorists in a concert hall over the weekend. He said the world should unite behind Russia against these Muslim terrorists, and they all need to be killed, their families killed. You know, all the stuff that Israel, if they ever dared say anything even remotely close to it, would be castigated. Nobody said a word when Putin said it. In one video, which is available all over the internet, a terrorist was being shown. He was beaten on the ground. His ear was then cut off on video and fed to him. He was forced to eat it. This is Russia. Nobody cares. Why? Because it's a Muslim terrorist, and it's not like they're Jews that are fighting back. In another video, there is one of the terrorists on the ground. He's stripped naked, and there looks like to be electrical wires about to be attached to his gonads. That's torture. But it's okay when Muslim terrorists, killer Muslim terrorists, are tortured as long as there's no Jews or Israel fighting back. No one said a peep. While Russia rightfully cries about Muslim terrorism that it experienced, what's obvious also is that karma is rewarding them with this massacre. After Hamas massacred 1,200 Israelis, including 16 Russian nationals, Putin refused to condemn Hamas, refused to describe it as terrorism, and instead blamed Israel and America. Now, of course, shooting up a concert hall, that's terrorism. Putin loudly criticized Israel's response in going after the terrorists. God knows how many innocents will die, as Putin will claim every political enemy he's ever had and the entire Ukraine. He'll claim they're responsible for the Muslim terror attack at the Moscow concert hall. But Biden and his administration have clearly demonstrated that the reason his approval rating on handling the Middle East is just at 25%, in his mind, he needs to bend over further for the Muslim terrorists who killed 40 Americans on October 7. Only 21% of independents support Biden's handling of this war, but somehow Biden is misreading this and believing he needs to go harder on Israel instead of going harder on the Muslim terrorists who killed Americans. I don't really get it. I don't know why. And the hysteria by Biden and his team has only grown louder as Israel moves closer to destroying Hamas, which is the pet of the Democratic Party, surely the loudest part of the party. Israel had cleaned out Gaza's Shifa hospital in November, finding Hamas terrorists there, weapons, a command center. Hamas had denied, naturally lie about everything, denied previously hiding in the hospital, but that was clearly false. After Israel left at that point to go on to other areas of Gaza to find terrorists, for some reason, Hamas was dumb enough to actually go back into the hospital And even after denying that they would ever use a hospital as a shield, this time Israel made a lightning strike on the hospital. And what did they find there? Well, they found 170 armed terrorists, which they killed. They arrested 800, including 480 terror operatives. They captured and killed senior Hamas leaders. 6,000 civilians in and around the hospital were safely relocated from the hospital and given food and care and housing. Over $3 million in cash was found inside the hospital, money that was used to pay Hamas terrorists, rifles, machine guns, grenades, all found inside the hospital. As I speak, there are still terrorists hiding in the emergency room of the hospital. Not one patient, not one doctor, not one nurse was killed in this raid. One Israeli soldier was killed, however. In comparison, the United States repeatedly bombed hospitals in Iraq during the war there if they believed the hospitals were used as terror centers. Notably, Israel did not criticize America when it did that. This was such a huge blow to Hamas that the screaming and the lies from them and their supporters all over social media are getting more outrageous. Just check out Twitter. In my life, I've never seen a place where there's so much open anti-Semitism to this level. The lies are so outrageous that it's almost not to be believed. I've read the large accounts on Twitter saying that Israelis drink the blood of Palestinians, target children, and now the latest, as Hamas is being finished off, is that Israel and its siege at the Shifa hospital is systematically raping Palestinian women and children. There's no evidence of this at all because it didn't happen. When Hamas, when they were using their GoPro cameras to kill Israelis on October 7th, raping, killing, murdering, there's all kinds of witnesses, all kinds of proof, broken pelvises, knife wounds inside vaginas of the dead victims. Hamas, leftists, they're all the same. They denied it. It was all a lie because Hamas would never do such a horrible thing because they're just above that. They're just okay with burning people alive. But of course, now they're saying that Israelis, the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, are raping people inside the Shifa hospital. There's no evidence again. It's just incredible, this type of lie that leftists and terrorists are coming out with. Except that it's been repeated so much that idiots believe it because they want to believe it. But to make matters worse, it's been reported, and I can't believe I'm saying this, that the American State Department official who's handling, I guess, this war on behalf of America, met with her Israeli counterpart and told him that Israel routinely sexually abuses Palestinian women. When asked for proof, the American, no doubt a leftist lunatic, said that the UN presented evidence, which it didn't. This unnamed American official also stated, "You did not provide evidence that Hamas is stealing humanitarian aid and you are starving the population." There couldn't be more massive proof that Hamas is stealing aid, attacking aid trucks, but the Biden administration is filled with so many deranged Jew haters that they're now parroting Hamas lying talking points, which go against all available evidence in existence. As for starving the population in Gaza, Israel has sent in over 341,000 tons. That's 341,000 times 2,000 pounds of aid since the war started. Over 11,000 trucks of aid. Over 27,000 tons of water to their enemy that raped, burned, and massacred them. Is Russia sending in any aid to the Ukraine as they're in the middle of the war? Did America, was they sending in aid as they were just hacking people to death in Iraq and Afghanistan? Did they do it right a few months into the war? Give me a fucking break. Not a single truck, let alone 11,000 trucks. Iran is watching America turn on Israel, is watching the rot from within with the Muslim terror supporters inside America changing policy. And we will all pay for it in America as they continue to ratchet up their own terror attacks on our soil. A fraction of this existed while Trump was president. It's true. And I hate Trump. So as bad as Trump is, and he is bad, at least he had better policies than Biden when it comes to immigration and foreign policy in dealing with Iran. Trump has to be reelected. We really have no other choice if we want to save our country. I have no doubt that Trump will screw up his 4 years, but it's better than purposely destroying America, which is what Joe Biden and his supporters are doing. Jeffrey Lichtman for Beyond the Legal Limit. You can find me on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts. See you next week. Thanks for tuning in.